You're listening to a Flashpoint special on Pacifica Radio, Israel's savaging of the Gaza Strip, a 21st century war crime. This is part three of a three-hour-long series on the brutal 22-day attack on the Gaza Strip by Israel and the United States between December 27, 2008 and January 18, 2009, including reports on the aftermath.
In the wake of the three-week carpet bombing of the Gaza Strip, many international agencies and human rights organizations are investigating the potential commission of a series of war crimes and crimes against humanity by Israeli occupation forces. The Israeli military campaign, fully armed by the United States, utilized the latest in advanced weaponry, including so-called unconventional weapons, such as dime bomb explosives and white phosphorus, on civilian populations.
15 top Israeli officials have been singled out for further investigation and may face arrest if they attempt to travel abroad in Europe. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority has called for a formal war crimes investigation into Israel's 22-day war against Gaza, which left over 1,300 Palestinians dead, including more than 400 children. Over 5,000 people were also wounded. The attacks also included the destruction of tens of thousands of houses, government buildings, schools, mosques, farms, UN and other international human rights centers, and all of the key hospitals across Gaza.
In part three of our Flashpoint special, you'll hear the voices of human rights activists and journalists who witnessed the 22-day siege from the ground and then returned with the residents to survey the damage in the aftermath. We'll also hear from Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, who stated that Israel's attacks might constitute a new kind of war crime on an imprisoned population without the ability to flee. And we'll feature a report from Nora Barrows Friedman, who documented the covert suppression of dissent from within the Green Line by Israeli government officials.
As we reported in part one, as the producers of the daily drive time news magazine Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we made the decision to devote the entire hour every day of this three-week assault to the news pouring out of Gaza. We wanted to make a contemporaneous record of the massive Israeli attack to help counteract the very effective Israeli-U.S. propaganda machine.
We now begin with part three of Flashpoint's special investigation, Israel's savaging of the Gaza Strip. A 21st century war crime.
I'm Sharon, I'm from Australia. I volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement here in Gaza right now. And as part of that, I've been one of several people riding with the Red Crescent ambulances. Well, we started to do that from our group because medics were being targeted by Israel, and there have been, I believe, about 10 or 11 now killed and more injured. And as that was taking place, we decided that we would offer to be with them and their work. And in doing that, I've been based at Al-Quds Hospital myself because that's where the Red Crescent moved to for their own base after their own building was attacked on December 27th when this all began. So they had a temporary base in Al-Quds Hospital.
And let's talk a little bit about what happened at the hospital. It was reported that Israeli airstrikes included three hospitals in a UN compound yesterday, and one of them was the hospital where you have been working out of Al-Quds. Could you tell us what happened, as much information as you have on that?
Yeah, well, let me see now. It was it began during Wednesday night. We were getting very heavy attacks in our area on Wednesday night, to the extent that we sent two of our ambulances out to be based at Al-Shifa Hospital. We kept two, but it became very clear that without some sort of coordination from Israel, there was no way we could go anywhere. So I actually went to sleep, which was a bit of a miracle. I haven't done that for a while. Then during the night, we had quite a lot of attacks, about 50 strikes people counted in our immediate area, and about four or five that actually hit our building, but didn't involve major damage. The two that did involve major damage happened in the morning. One was a rocket that went through the wall of the hospital into the pharmacy building, and we retrieved the rocket shell. and the other was went through the roof of the social centre, which is part of the hotel complex, and started a fire. So we had a massive hole in the roof and a fire, and the medics were fighting the fire and did manage to put it out eventually, but that was quite difficult. And then actually we were only just in the middle of doing that, getting the last bits of the fire, when we heard shouting from upstairs. And I went up to the main steps, and I saw my medic colleague, Mohammed, covered in blood. And he said that he'd just picked up a little girl who was part of a family that were actually fleeing their house and coming to the hospital. And he'd heard screaming and gone out. I mean, we hadn't been setting foot outside the building, really, because it wasn't safe, but he'd heard that there was something wrong. So he went out, and she'd actually been shot by a sniper. She had gunshot wound to her face and also to her abdomen. And so he swept her up and brought her in, and he just handed her over for surgery. And then as he was explaining this, the father of the child came up the steps and fell, and he'd actually been shot in the leg by the sniper. So we helped him in, and then the mother was there, and she was really upset because there was one daughter still left behind. And up until that point, we'd been hoping we could get some sort of coordination from Israel to have a ceasefire so we could go and get the wounded, because we'd been getting lots of calls that we couldn't respond to. But once we heard that there were just people in the street, you know, we just decided, okay, we'll just go. We'll, you know, in our Red Crescent best, trying to, you know, basically look like, you know, we're some sort of safety point for people to try and get them off the street into the hospital. So we went and got this little girl. Mohammed carried her back in, and we could see lots of people were on the streets. And what had been happening was people's houses had been being struck. There were houses on fire. The army had actually entered into many houses and taken away the men of the homes. So people were just really scared. And even though it was dangerous to be on the streets, they felt better coming to the hospital and staying at home. So for the next couple of hours, we were escorting people. Kind of under the eye of tanks, we could see the tanks in this residential area just behind where we were going. And people were really scared, you know, they were carrying children and belongings and just in a panic. And we did that for a couple of hours and then pretty much got everyone that was going to leave and then tried to work out what to do, because the hospital was completely full. We had about 500 extra people there. And it was decided to do a walking evacuation, which I think had permission from Israel in the end, because I know we had two ambulances. We were only allowed to take two ambulances, so people who couldn't walk, you know, we could fit in as many as possible, but we were pushing people in wheelchairs. And we walked them down under a big black smoke cloud, which we later found out was the UNRWA building going up in flames. We walked them down to an UNRWA school. And people were able to disperse from there to the extent that they had friends and relatives. And then really it took some time to do that, and we got back to the hospital, which obviously still had patients in. And it can't have been more than an hour before there were more strikes to the building, and one actually set the roof of the middle building on fire so seriously that it began to burn like really speedily, and we had to evacuate everybody. We tried to get the firefighters to come, and were in a situation where they were saying, we have to get coordination from Israel first or we'll be opened fire upon, which is often the case. So there was a delay to fighting the fire. And in the meantime, the medics of the hospital had got the hoses out and were just standing at the windows of the main hospital building where the wards were, trying to hose the fire in the next door building. And parts of the roof of that building were falling through into the basement, which is where the obstetrics and the emergency departments are. So there was a point where I was downstairs in the basement and it was actually on fire just next to the obstetrics ward. So we got everybody out, and then of course we had them all in the street, and it was dark and there'd been sniper fire and explosions all day. So some of them had come there to escape that, and now we were putting them out in the street again. We had people in hospital beds that we were carrying down steps, and we just had to start moving people down the road. Shortly after that, we did start to get ambulances from other hospitals coming to us as an emergency response, but it was just a really chaotic scene and obviously very frightening for everybody.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with a member of the International Solidarity Movement, Sharon Locke. She has been riding with the Red Crescent ambulances through these days of very heavy bombing attacks by the Israeli military. And we're talking, Sharon, so everybody understands, we're talking about a fairly significant hospital in the center in Gaza City that was repeatedly targeted by Israeli bombs? The hospital itself?
Yes. And I understand that on the same day, Al-Wafa Hospital was also targeted. I mean, these things aren't accidents. These are the tactics that Israel is using. And frankly, I can't see the logic. So what I'm seeing is just terror, basically. I just think they want to reinforce to people that there is nowhere safe here. You know, there is no logic to attacking a hospital. There are never fighters in hospitals. The medical staff would just not stand for that for one moment. I've observed that very clearly. Even in the way the ambulances run, they won't go into an area without shouting that you know, fighters must vacate the area because they'll have nothing to do with them. That's their policy, as is, you know, that generally of medical workers worldwide. There's no excuse for targeting a hospital. I mean, one of the initial rockets that fell outside and started burning outside the building, which was right by a window I was standing at, started a fire, which was about 10 yards from the pediatric unit. We had triplets, three little babies in incubators, you know, just a matter of yards from where this fire was starting from the rocket. And the hose wouldn't go that far, so the medics were putting that out with pots and pans of water. I mean, you know, this is not a highly resourced place, and the weapons technology that's being used on civilians is a shocking thing.
Sharon, let me follow up this way. So there you are, this multiple attacks. You're forced, as the fires get worse, to take hundreds of people into the streets with several ambulances to get them away in the midst of sniper fire. This is after the building was attacked. I guess I want to just talk to you a little bit more, if we could, about some of the other people. You mentioned the little girl who your colleague, medical colleague, carried in bloody. What happened to her? And who are some of the other people that you met in this extraordinary attack, which really appears to be a crime against humanity?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is what we have international law for, so that no one behaves like this. The family, it was the Albatran's family, that had injuries from the snipers. And the little 9-year-old that my colleague carried in, her name was Hanin, and she's now in Shifa Hospital. I haven't had a chance yet to find out what her status is, but I believe she's doing okay after her surgery. Her sister Yasmin was 12, and they were just trying to get somewhere safe from their home, and you know, the snipers don't do things accidentally. They're trained to be very precise. We had another couple of sniper injuries as well, actually. There was a man who had a gunshot wound to his arm, which we treated while we were in the street, under the eyes of snipers, still, one would imagine. What we did find, actually, because we contacted our organization, the ISM, and said this is happening, and they press released this and asked people to contact Israeli authorities and say, stop, you know, this is wrong, stop it, we know you're doing this. And we didn't have further sniper injuries that day that I'm aware of. The other people that I met, once the hospital filled up with evacuees from their houses, there were a lot of people there trying to work out what to do. And there was a young woman who actually I'd met when she was volunteering with a youth organization called Mercy Corps. So she chatted to me in earlier days, and she spotted me there, and she actually called me on her mobile so that she could get my attention in the middle of all the chaos. And she said, you know, my mom's got hypertension and my gran's in a wheelchair, and you know, if we're walking out of here, I don't know how they'll do, and, you know, is there any other way? And because we were only allowed, with the plan made with Israel, to take two ambulances, we had to make them walk. You know, we were just pushing her gran in the wheelchair and her mum, who was in a great state of stress, had to walk, you know. And she's pretty young. She's only about 17, and she just had the weight of, you know, trying to keep the family all okay under all this pressure on her own shoulders. I spoke to another woman who was there with three little children, and her husband was a doctor, and he'd been taken away by the army. So she was saying to me, do you know where they've taken the men? And I was saying, I don't know anything. You know, we have no information about that. We're just hearing these reports.
Husband was taken away after the invasion, the ground invasion by Israeli forces?
This happened yesterday. This is one of the reasons that people were fleeing their houses, because the army had come into some of the houses and taken the men away. And at that point yesterday, and I haven't been able to look into this yet today because of other things I've been doing, but this is a very common tactic by Israel when they have an incursion. They'll go into houses and they'll take away the men. And this will often be anybody over the age of 13 and under the age of 60. It just seems to be a policy thing, you know. And sometimes they'll be returned the next day. Sometimes they won't come back at all. Sometimes they'll be beaten. Sometimes they'll be kept in prison for a while. So, you know, when this happens, it was one of the things that meant that the women and children just wanted to leave the houses because, you know, they'd lost their husbands and fathers and didn't know when they'd get them back and just felt completely vulnerable. So they wanted to be with us in the hospital.
Wow. And the triplets, did they survive?
Who? Yes. Well, they're an interesting story, actually. As of 2 days ago, they were 28 days old, and they were fine, actually. They didn't need to be in hospital anymore, but they were separated from their parents because of the situation. They had to have a little bit of time in hospital when they were newborn, and then before their mother and father could come to collect them, Israel cut the north-south route. So the family is actually in Han Yunus, and it's almost impossible to travel from Han Yunus now. So the hospital, a good hospital, was just looking after them in a guardian position, really. And they were in their little humidity cribs and getting well fed, and they were fine. But this is the first 28 days of their life, they didn't have their mom. And I believe they've been shifted to Al Shifa. That's something else I'd like to look into.
Well, you talk about their parents being cut off in the south. There was heavy bombing down there and heavy attacks, I understand, with tanks and bulldozers, and a lot of houses were destroyed. So I hope that the parents of the triplets are okay in Khan Yunis, because that's been certainly another difficult and deadly place. And I guess you're going to go out and ride again with the ambulance?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very positive role to have. And in the kind of increasing stress, you know, sometimes I look around for the medic and find that I'm the medic. I've got basic skills. I can bandage. I can stop bleeding. You know, I can't do anything clever, but we're just getting so many injuries. And you know, most of the medics are sleeping very little. They're having almost no off time. So anything I can do to alleviate what they're having to deal with, the better.
And there multiple struggles in terms of going out and actually getting to the people who need help? Or are there still attacks? Please talk about that. Still attacks going on?
There are. You know, I was speaking to someone just today who was shot at while he was in the ambulance. But also, now that Israel controls so many areas, they're just not permitting the wounded to be collected at all. So there's constant negotiation going on where each day the Red Crescent and the Red Cross will talk together. They'll say, okay, we've been getting loads of emergency calls from this area or that area. And then the Red Cross, who have this liaison role, will ring up Israel, ring up the army and say, we want to take ambulances and people to this area and collect the wounded. And Israel sometimes will say yes. And sometimes when they say yes, they still shoot at the ambulance convoy when it goes. And most of the time at the moment, they're just saying no, you can't come, you can't collect the wounded, it's not possible, we don't agree. So this is, there was a point early on, about a week ago, when we were riding with ambulances in Jabalia, and this was happening as the army took over space there, and the ambulance coordinator estimated that 80% of the calls were not able to be responded to. Now that means there are people dying without care needlessly, and there have been some horrendous stories of you know, children being left with parents who've died, and that the children have been alone. People dying of injuries that could have been mended had the ambulance been allowed to reach them.
80% of the calls not being able to be responded to. I have two more questions. First of all, in terms of the hospital, we've heard that there are claims that Al-Quds was hit with white phosphorus weapons. Any indication, any burns, any shells? What do we know?
I'm not aware of that. I don't actually know, because I don't know what I'd be looking for. I've seen the white phosphorus in the sky, but when you're underneath it, you know, it's a different situation. There was a chemical smell that could have been just parts of the building that were burning. I know it was confirmed that they used white phosphorus on the UNRWA building. I didn't see any evidence of burns on this occasion.
How would you evaluate the number of civilians? The Israelis tend to say 75-80% of the people hit are Hamas leaders, terrorists. What's your assessment of impact on civilian versus so-called militant or resistance?
Well, you know, I was listening to the Al Jazeera news channel a little earlier, and their figures were of the injuries and deaths. I think deaths were 40% children, and injuries were 50% women and children. And that's discounting elderly people, so you've got to factor them in as well. And then you're left with a percentage that is men, and of the percentage that is men, maybe some tiny percentage is going to be fighters, but that's not the majority of who is getting hit
here.
And
what are you seeing?
That's reflected in what I'm seeing. I mean, I actually, on my blog just a couple of days ago, said that for the first time I was aware of having a fighter in my ambulance. One, that was the first one that I was aware of clearly being a fighter in, I think it was about 2 weeks. And the thing is that we're getting children, we're getting women, we're getting old people, we're getting family groups. That's happening constantly, because if you rocket a house, you'll get four or five people. So, okay, there'll be a man in his 30s in amongst that family group. I don't exactly know what the demographic of a Hamas fighter is, but, you know, perhaps that would be the age group you'd look for. But he's there with his kids and his wife. And, you know, so this is not a situation that there's fighting going on. It's a family house. So that's been what I've seen. And any time I'm unclear about it, I ask the medics and say, is there any chance this person is a fighter? And because people are from local regions, there's usually information that can be got. They can say, no, this is the guy who, you know, who fixes computers, or, you know, this is the brother of my uncle, or people know who the fighters are. And that's not who we've been getting in the ambulance that I've been in until the other day when we got the first one. And the medic did say clearly, yes, this is a fighter. You know, they have no agenda in this. They collect the wounded. They're very happy to tell me their impression of the situation. And also, like, when we collect injured people, if we go to an area where there has been fighting, then, you know, there's obviously that's likely to be where the fighters are. If we're going to civilian areas, to houses, to family homes, then very clearly we're not going to an area where there's been fighting. We're not picking up bodies of fighters. We're picking up ordinary civilians from their homes or schools or places of work.
All right. Well, we have been speaking with Sharon Locke of the International Solidarity Movement, taking notes and riding the ambulance with the Red Crescent out of El Quds Hospital, which was bombed multiple times over the last several days by Israeli aircraft or drones, or who knows where the weapons are being fired from. We know that a lot of snipers as well. Sharon Locke, very important work that you're doing. There is a shutdown on the flow of information, and so the material that you give us and our audience is very much appreciated. We hope that you will remain safe with the rest of the crew, and I hope we can talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio as we air part three of our three-part series, The Savaging of the Gaza Strip, a 21st Century War Crime. These interviews are collected from the third week of Israel's bombing operations against the Palestinians entrapped inside Gaza. Please stay tuned.
My name is Eva Bartlett. I'm a Canadian human rights advocate and freelance journalist, and I'm now in Gaza City. I spent the day touring the perimeter of Gaza City with another journalist activist from Spain, Alberto Arce, and we basically visited areas where the Israeli troops had entered and had been shelling. And what we saw a lot of damage, of course, to houses, and we saw a lot of people still fleeing their houses because they're afraid of the shelling, because they've lost people in their family, people in their family have been killed. And so they're leaving their houses in streams, carrying, again, just small amounts of belongings with them, bags of bread, you know, whatever they can grab before they leave. Some people who had left the area were actually returning during the daytime because the tanks had retreated some, so the families figured that they could go home and pick up some belongings and maybe get some food and then leave again at night, because they certainly don't feel safe there at night. What we saw starting along the coast, we saw a hotel, two actually, side by side, that had been destroyed last night around 2 a.m., I think it was. And it was each one was taken down by an F-16 missile. both these hotels, the owners say they are not politically active. They don't know why their hotels were targeted. They're both relatively new, and the owners themselves were already crippled under the siege and trying to pay off the debts of constructing the hotels. And now, of course, there's no way they can pay it off, and there's extensive the damages done by this the bombings just have put them further into debt. So we saw that first, and then we moved along the coast to the south, reaching the edge. It's called Sheikh Rajmin, and it's an area where the tanks had advanced into. They had come from the former settlement, Netzarim. And so that's where we saw a number of people streaming from their houses. We saw fields that had contained fig trees and other plants that were very fertile fields that had been raised by tanks. We saw the tank treads and bulldozer treads. And then we visited houses, and in one house we saw a very black smoke around the edge of its window. And we went inside, and the man took us up to the second floor. He told us, he showed us the hole where the missile had come through the roof. And we looked in one corner of the room, and there's still a fire smoking. We didn't notice it right away because we were busy looking at all the damage done. And he told us this missile had hit. It was 3 days before. And then we noticed there was still fire smoking. And we'd already suspected that this had been some sort of chemical missile. We don't know to what extent, like what nature of chemical it was. But when we went to the fire and poked around at it, it suddenly, like it very quickly flamed up and then burning very, very brightly with a nasty chemical smell. And afterwards, after we had taken some photographs, then one of the men poured water on it, and it briefly, looked like it had gone out, and then it flashed up again. And so we believe very much that it was a chemical fire because of that and because of the smell. Before that, we had visited a couple of houses where there were martyrs in each house. The first one had received two missiles. One missile coming early hours of the morning, one son came out of his house to see what had been done, and a second missile came shortly after, killing him. In another house, the missile actually came into the house and killed this man's son. He was an 18-year-old university student, and he was on the second floor when the missile struck. So, again, this is just a repeat of all the civilian deaths we've heard about through Gaza. We went next to the Zaytun area, which has become famous for the extended family, the Samouni family, that was locked into a house which was a day later bombed, killing huge numbers. I believe it's over 30. And then it was an area that was off limits to medics, to ambulances, and emergency workers for a number of days, meaning that even if there were wounded people there, they stood a good chance of dying. Miraculously, some people did survive. But we were in a different area of Zaytun, and we saw a number of houses that had been just bulldozed. And the man that was kind of showing us around, he said it was anywhere from 15 to 20 houses that had been bulldozed last night, bulldozed and struck by missiles. And as we were there, of course, there were surveillance drones flying overhead, and a couple of Apaches approached us, so we started leaving because we heard gunfire and didn't want to be there when that got heavy, the gunfire coming from the Apaches. And finally, we went to an area to the west of Gaza City, and it was an area that had also been struck quite a bit last night, and we'd seen it from the media building, and serious missiles. And we went and we saw a tall apartment building, and the man that met us there, just some man on the street, was telling us that there were at least 9 martyrs from that apartment building, and he thought that probably the Israeli army would come back again tonight. So from what we understand, they're trying to encroach on Gaza City, but they pull out during the day, kind of flexing their muscles, killing people. I'm not a political analyst, so I can't predict what's going to happen. But again, we certainly saw the evidence of some sort of chemical weapons.
We're speaking with Eva Bartlett. She's a Canadian freelance journalist, a member of the International Solidarity Movement, an activist on the ground who has been trying to evaluate the landscape of destruction that has been left by now 18 days of Israeli bombings from land, air, and sea, tanks, drones, F-16s, ships offshore, and the killing continues. In terms of being out there in the middle of these this situation where people have just been killed, the bodies, I guess, some are still there. Do you come across wounded people, families who aren't getting what they need just in terms of the medical care?
It's hard for me to say, actually, but what we do come across, definitely families that haven't been reached by the medics because, again, these many, many areas are off limits and require some sort of coordination, and that coordination is next to impossible to get. And now, because of the attacks on the UN worker and on a Red Cross worker, the Red Cross has temporarily said that it's, well, I might be wrong about that, but they definitely the UN has said that it is suspending its actions here. And I know that it still remains very, very difficult for ambulances to reach these injured and sick people. But of course, yeah, definitely I would say, without being an expert in medicine, that there isn't the medicine and the definitely not the equipment available that people need to be treated. Some people have been able to be sent to Egypt, but the numbers of wounded are so high that sending a handful to Egypt now and then is not adequate, period.
Eva, you're in the El Kout Hospital. I guess that's in Gaza City. Describe what life has been like in the hospital over the last day or so, and what's happening there.
Actually, I'm sorry. I'm only here briefly because I was in transit and someone picked me up, and rather than make them take me to the media office where I wanted to go do some media work, I came back here with them, but so I can't actually talk about the Kut Hospital.
All right. And what are your concerns at this point in terms of what you saw? Israel says it has no intention of stopping the bombing. There's a real concern that it's going to enter more and more heavily, densely populated areas, risking more civilians. What are the concerns on the ground?
The concerns are, well, again, aside from the medical concerns, the concerns are inadequate supplies of food, of basic staples like bread, and there's absolutely nowhere people feel safe. And so more and more people are becoming displaced because more and more people are fleeing areas where Israeli troops enter. And as they do that, the UN schools become overcrowded. And, of course, nobody feels safe anywhere, including the UN schools, because of what happened a few days ago. The concerns are just when is this going to end and how are we going to get through this and are we going to get through this? And so many people I talk to just say we peace one day where there's no one being killed. And the average people being killed is anywhere from 50 to 100 some days. So I guess the concerns are just like that we can't handle this, you know. This is the end of the 18th day, and we can't take it much longer. And I'm saying we. I don't mean me personally, because I'm one of the fortunate ones. It's not living in the buffer areas where people are really feeling it. You know, they're being down in Issa Khan Yunis, people are being assaulted by land and by what we believe is some sort of chemical similar to white phosphorus, if it isn't already white phosphorus. So, it's a huge, huge, obviously, humanitarian situation, and the number of injured is just increasing dramatically. Just this has already scaled beyond expectation and control.
All right, Eva Bartlett, working as a freelance journalist and touring the landscape of destruction left after some 18 days of these attacks that are continuing. We thank you for risking your life to see what's going on, because the information blockade is very difficult and makes it almost impossible to get information that we need to know what's happening on the ground. So thanks for being with us, and please continue to be as careful as you can.
Will do. Thanks, Dennis.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we're honored now to be joined by the honorable professor from Princeton. We're talking about Richard Falk. He is currently the UN special reporter on human rights in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. He attempted actually to get in to Israel last month and was prevented. Professor Falk, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and let me begin this way. Please assess, from your information, from the sources that you have, how would you characterize very specifically the impact of the current air, land, and sea war on the people of the Gaza Strip?
I think that one needs to recognize that this is a devastating series of attacks on a civilian population that was already gradually weakened by 18 months of blockade that restricted the entry of food, medicine, and fuel in such a way that international civil servants on the ground in Gaza and journalists were anticipating the possible collapse of Gazan society. So it's important to recognize that these attacks came on top of this prior situation that had already driven the civilian society to the point of near desperation.
Now, there's a lot of things being said, not a lot of information in the United States through the mainstream press, but there's strong sentiment around the world that a move towards genocide, pre-genocide, this is an attempt at ethnic cleansing. So help us put that into context. Again, how do you see, are we close? Are we getting close to a humanitarian catastrophe, a war crime? How would you say that?
Well, I think it's important to be careful with the use of language here. In my view, it is already an unfolding humanitarian catastrophe. The legal implications of that situation are more complex. I think there is no doubt that the Israeli attacks since December 27th constitute massive violations of international humanitarian law and of the UN Charter that prohibits the non-defensive use of force. Whether these violations add up to crimes against humanity is something that needs to be validated by looking at the intentions behind the attacks and getting some evidence as to what the actual intentions were, which are probably quite different than the publicly proclaimed explanations of the attacks. And that's even more true in relation to genocide and ethnic cleansing. The International Court of Justice tried to assess the contention that there was genocide committed by Serbia in Bosnia in the 1990s. And even though there was a very plain pattern of ethnic cleansing from a political perspective and a moral perspective, the great majority of the court declined to conclude that there was genocide from a legal perspective, except in the narrow situation of the massacre at Srebrenica in 1995. So I think it's important, particularly given my UN role, that I not be understood as suggesting that genocide or ethnic cleansing are part of the established reality at the moment, however gruesome it is from moral and political perspectives.
You said today that it's irresponsible to exclude Hamas from the international participation in the UN, other arenas. The United States, Condoleezza Rice, George Bush, current president, hold Hamas accountable. The Senate, the Congress of the United States are considering a very condemning proposal, sentiment of the Congress against Hamas as the key, putting the key blame at their foot. What's your response?
Well, I'm as an American, I'm really sad about that kind of response that is so one-sided, so out of touch with the sentiments that exist on the part of morally concerned people throughout the world, really, and increasingly in this country as well. I think there's a tipping point that we're approaching that is turning this conflict over the future of Palestine into the most important symbolic issue for the world since the anti-apartheid struggle of the 1980s. And for the United States government, at least, to be so out of touch with that is a rather alarming exposure of the degree to which our policies are distorted by domestic pressure groups.
Now, in terms of the role of Hamas?
Well, yes. I mean, that's one expression of I think, dysfunctional character of U.S. diplomacy is not to treat Hamas as a political actor, however regrettable some of its past policies may have been. It is the effective governmental authority in Gaza. Its representatives were elected in a free election backed by the United States in January of 2006. And if one wants to resolve the conflict, Hamas has proposed solutions that seem to me to be in accord with international law and to be quite reasonable. They are proposing a mutual long-term ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, and a opening of the crossings that will enable the end of the blockade and a resumption of at least normal occupancy conditions that are already difficult because Gaza is an impoverished society at best.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Richard Falk from Princeton, who is now the UN Special Reporter on Human Rights in the Occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He attempted to get into Israel last month, but couldn't do so. I want to tap your legal expertise here again, talking about, we rarely hear in the U.S. press this word occupation or illegal occupation of Palestine. I want to ask you about the right to resist an illegal occupation and also the back and forth around disproportionate responses, the Hamas and their supporters firing rockets into Israel and the Israeli attacks, cutoff, invasion, so on and so forth.
Those are difficult questions, and I can just give partial answers to them, but there is a right of resistance against an unlawful, sustained occupation. It's been widely recognized in the West ever since World War II, when there was resistance in France and elsewhere in Europe to Nazi occupation, to German occupation at that time. And so the more difficult issues are, what are the limits of right of resistance? And here I support the view that it is never legally or morally permissible to deliberately target civilians as a instrument of resistance. So what constitutes legitimate tactics and targets of resistance is a difficult and complicated issue, but there clearly does exist a right of resistance on the part of the Palestinian people. The overall tactics that have been employed by Israel have one feature that has been not very well articulated in the media, and that is the entrapment of a civilian population in a war zone. The Gazans have been denied the option of becoming refugees, which is, of course, not a pleasant option to choose, but if you're seeking safety from a war zone that is threatening your life and the life of your family and children and so on, the refugee option is the least terrible option available to civilian societies, particularly in a place like Gaza, where the density of population is so great and the area is so small. But Israel has closed the exit. I mean, it has basically locked the population into this war zone. And as far as I know, that hasn't really happened before in such a systematic way. And it probably should be considered a new kind of war crime.
Well, finally, part of the problem here and part of the work has to do with documenting what's happening and after it's over, what happened, and to put it into some context and to see if there are patterns that lead us to various conclusions. But you are not allowed in there. Now, you're a significant person to turn away. Bishop Desmond Tutu, who was one of the leaders you referred earlier to the anti-apartheid movement, was turned away. We did see the United Nations adopt significant words having to do with information as a human right. So what about the inability to document, to report, to be able to clearly, contemporaneously document what's going on? Is that a where does that come into this?
My exclusion, I think, was part of a wider pattern that Israel has been pursuing in recent months of trying to obscure the actuality of the occupation of the West Bank and particularly of Gaza. And it was partly to send a message to the UN that it was not going to cooperate in exposing this reality, but, and it is reinforced by the severe restrictions on the entry of foreign journalists, the exclusion of those journalists during the current campaign, while giving them free access to any kind of damage resulting from rockets fired from Gaza, and the failure to let qualified Palestinians who have knowledge of the conditions in Gaza leave. So it is the pursuit of what I've called the political opaqueness, trying to make it as difficult as possible to get credible report on the actuality of suffering that the civilian population in Gaza has been enduring before the attacks of December 27th and even more dramatically since then.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Richard Falk, with the United Nations Organizations on Human Rights. He's the Special Rapporteur for the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. As we said, he actually tried to get in about a month ago. You could have found yourself in the middle of this war if they had let you in. I guess maybe they knew it was coming. What about the fact that the United States rushed over a great deal of weaponry that is now being used against Gaza? Does the United States play a role? Do they have a responsibility?
Yes, of course they have a responsibility. I mean, both a domestic legal responsibility, because the weaponry is supposed to be only used in a defensive mode, and then a political responsibility as a complicit actor that undoubtedly had advanced knowledge and lent approval to this campaign and has obstructed efforts at the United Nations and elsewhere to secure a effective ceasefire as immediately as possible. So the U.S. is unfortunately very much in the eyes of the world, and from a more disciplined legal perspective, very much engaged as a partner with Israel in conducting this Gaza campaign. And it's something I regret very much as an American, seeing my government engaged in such policies.
Well, they had to know when they were turning you away that you could present a real problem if they were getting ready to start a war.
Yes. I mean, it's hard always to speculate on what the Israeli motives are, because what is disclosed is probably not what is the actual explanation for the behavior, and I think that applies probably to my exclusion. One thing I didn't mention that I think is important is that if you look at this campaign that has been conducted over the last 13 days, it's been claimed to be about making Israel secure against rocket fire. But the actuality is that for the period of 6 months prior to December 27th, not a single Israeli casualty had resulted from rocket fire. A ceasefire had been rather effectively in place, and Hamas had been prepared at all stages to extend that ceasefire up to 10 years. And so one has to assume that there were other motivations for this attack, which, according to knowledgeable strategic observers, had been planned for at least 3 months and probably 6 months. And one of these objectives is to use the rocket attacks as a pretext for destroying Hamas as a political actor and providing Gaza with the same kind of governance that exists in the West Bank under the authority of Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. A second, I think, important undisclosed motivation is the effort of both the foreign minister Livni and the defense minister Barak, who are candidates in the national election scheduled for February, to show that they are tough enough to safeguard Israel and that Israelis don't have to vote for the extreme right-wing candidate Netanyahu, who prior to the campaign was actually quite far ahead in the polls. And finally, I think it's important to take account of the motivation of the Israeli Defense Forces. They're very powerful military institutions, which were didn't disguise very much their interest in having the opportunity to show that they were still a preeminent and efficient military force and overcome the impression that had been left that they had declined as a result of the failure of the military operations in the 2006 Lebanon War. So there are a lot of reasons for this campaign, but none of the serious explanations has to do with trying to protect Israelis from the rocket fire.
All right. Well, we thank you for spending this amount of time with us, Professor Richard Falk, now with the United Nations Special Reporting on Human Rights in the Occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Very important information, helps us understand a lot from the legal side of this, and we, again, are very grateful. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Now, Nora Barrows-Friedman, Flashpoint senior producer, reports from a demonstration near the northern Israeli city of Haifa that took place earlier today. Since the assault on Gaza began nearly 3 weeks ago, there have been daily protests taking place inside Israel, mostly in Palestinian areas of Israeli cities and towns. The Israeli Secret Service has arrested nearly 800 Palestinian youth that are citizens of Israel. They are being held around the state. They still hold dozens of these prisoners in a prison where Nora was today and where that demonstration took place. Also joining the demonstrations and the demonstrators are groups of Israeli anarchists who have also been targeted by the Secret Service. Nora began by speaking with Kobi, an Israeli anarchist activist who joined the protests near Haifa today, followed by Palestinian citizens of Israel who have been organizing these fierce demonstrations in resistance to Israel's massacres in Gaza and the oppressive policies of the state.
We're standing in front of Kishon Prison, also called Jalameh, not far from Haifa in northern Israel. There's a protest here against the wave of detention that it coincides with the attack on Gaza. Hundreds of arrests have been made of dissidents, mostly Palestinians, At least 27 are remanded without jail, and many more are have their arrest extended. It's hard to even keep track of these things because it's so widespread, but this is the minimum of it, at least those numbers.
And this has been since the assault on Gaza began nearly 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, since the very beginning of the assault on Gaza, the police have changed their attitude and have increased their aversion to any kind of political expression. More arrests, indictments are filed immediately. All of this is quite new. Before the assault on Gaza, it was a lot easier to have a demonstration. These days, every simple vigil with a small number of people is at risk of being rounded up and arrested. Just last night in Beersheva, the entire demonstration was rounded up, including a former parliament member. In Tel Aviv, a small vigil in front of the Egyptian embassy was all rounded up. During the arraignment, the prosecution said that the people were also hurting the nation's morale. One has to wonder, maybe she means the Egyptian nation's morale. She was rebuked by the judge for even mentioning these things, but the police still operate under the assumption and the guidelines that every political expression now is to be repressed and prevented.
Kobe, can you tell us a little bit about who you are, the work that you do, and kind of the, you know, everyone in the States wants to know about what the Israeli peace activists or the Israeli peace movement is doing. Can you talk a little bit about what you do and your response to, really, is there a peace movement and is it active and what is it doing now?
It's a good question about the Israeli peace movement. Just this morning I saw a poll that says that 82% of Israelis think that the army operation in Gaza is not too much. It's appropriate. This means that it's practically the entire Jewish Israeli population. The number of dissidents is quite small. It does exist. There are Jewish dissidents. There is resistance in the Arab community. Huge demonstrations in Sakhnin and other Arab centers. Unfortunately, the level of dissent in the Jewish community is much too small.
And you work with Israeli anarchists. Can you talk a little bit about the actions that they've been doing over the last 2.5 weeks?
There is a coalition of Israeli groups against the war. Anarchists Against the Wall is part of it. There have been demonstrations in Tel Aviv, other demonstrations, some direct actions. There was one at the entrance to an Air Force base from which pilots leave to go to their missions. There have been protests in front of the Defense Ministry. Virtually every day in Tel Aviv and in Haifa, there is a demonstration. So there's a lot of activity. Unfortunately, as I said, not nearly enough dissent in the Jewish community.
And that was part 3 of Flashpoint's special on Israel's savaging of the Gaza Strip, a 21st century war crime, a collection of interviews recorded during the siege and compiled as a contemporaneous record of the Israeli assault on Gaza. These segments were produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Dennis Bernstein, with technical production by Eric Klein and Amanda Bellerby. For comments and questions, please email us at flashpoints@kpfa.org.